Hello and welcome to another Inside Education podcast. On today's programme, I bring you the first part of an interview I conducted with Professor Catherine Snow from Harvard University. Professor Snow visited the country earlier this year at the invitation of the Reading Association of Ireland. Catherine Snow is an expert on how children develop language and literacy. She's particularly interested in how oral language skills are acquired and how they relate to literacy outcomes. Catherine Snow's research activities include a longitudinal study of language and literacy skills among low-income children who have been followed for 15 years since they were 3 years old, and studying the vocabulary development of first and second language learners. Her book, Preparing Our Teachers: Opportunities for Better Reading Instruction, is one of several efforts she is involved in to develop consensus among teacher educators about what pre- and in-service elementary teachers need to know about language and literacy. Catherine Snow gave a keynote address at the 37th Annual Conference of the Reading Association of Ireland at the end of September 2013. Her talk was titled, Promoting Classroom Discussion to Improve Reading Comprehension: Results from the Implementation of Word Generation in Grades 6 to 8. I spoke to Catherine Snow after her talk, and I'll bring you that interview in two parts. On next week's podcast, we'll hear her views about learning vocabulary, burning questions or dilemmas with no right answer, managing classroom discussions, how parents can help develop children's language, delays in developing language, the impact of educational research on education practice, and the difference between language and literacy. But we'll begin this week with another set of topics. We'll hear Catherine Snow's views on how learning a second language helps or hinders learning the first language, how she defines literacy, how debates can support reading comprehension, and how teachers can recognise students' progress in language learning and academic language. During her address, Catherine spoke about the need for children to develop academic language. In the interview afterwards, I asked her how she would respond to a teacher or a parent who said, "Well, I'm not too concerned about academic language. I just want children to be able to speak well, read well, and write well."
I would say that some of what we mean when we say speak well is indeed academic language, that in certain contexts, speaking well requires having some control over features of academic language. It's not as if academic language is a completely different form of language from day-to-day language or playground language. It's that academic language sort of embodies certain capacities for judgment and argumentation that are actually cognitive capacities, and these cognitive capacities get expression in academic language and are clearly supported by academic language. So I'm not proposing that we turn all children into monolingual academic language speakers. The idea is that in order to appreciate certain nuances of meaning, it's important to be able to distinguish between reject and deny, for example, or to be able to distinguish between the consequence for your listener of saying you're wrong versus, well, I disagree with you on a certain aspect of what you just said, where the second one is more polite, but it's also more nuanced in the degree to which it reflects the speaker's level of confidence in what he or she is saying. So academic language is valuable in its own right. We wouldn't elect a political leader who didn't have some control over academic language. We wouldn't choose someone to participate in a public debate who didn't have some control over academic language. But it's also important as an opportunity to practice skills that then will also very much be relevant to reading and writing, because it's easier for children and for adults, for that matter, to learn language forms orally. And then those same language forms often are encountered in reading. It's important to know what they mean. And we need them in writing certain kinds of texts.
So when you're calling for children and teenagers to learn academic language, you're talking about all children acquiring that kind of language?
I'm absolutely talking about all children acquiring that kind of language, yes. What we often see with second language speakers in the States, for example, is that well-educated kids go far beyond their native language skill in English in academic language domains. So this is something that is typically learned at school. It's learned with support from curriculum and from literacy tasks. And it's very important in making an impression on the world of the kind that we want to be able to make. If you go to a job interview or want to make an argument about something in a class or in a public setting, doing it in the context of academic language with academic language skills is just much more effective.
I'm thinking, though, of some children who maybe grow up in an environment where academic language might be talked about as speaking posh, mm-hmm. or it might be very much at odds with the register of the street language that is spoken in that particular area, or where children who actually use academic language might actually be out of place. Mm-hmm. How do you balance children's need to be able to fit in the environment in which they're growing up and the need to be able to be more sophisticated in their use of language?
Well, that's a really important point. But one dimension of academic language skill, as it's been defined by my colleague Paolo Uccelli, is a meta-linguistic awareness of academic language and when it should be used and when it should be avoided. I mean, obviously, in the locker room, one doesn't talk about urination, right? Similarly, on the playground, one doesn't say, "I respectfully disagree with you." But having the capacity to shift from more formal to less formal forms and knowing when which is appropriate, that's a very crucial aspect of academic language skill.
You mentioned as well second language learners. How does learning a second language help or hinder the development of a first language and literacy in that language?
Whether learning a second language helps or hinders depends very much on the local context and the sociolinguistic context in which the language acquisition is happening. There's a widely talked about distinction between additive bilingualism, the kind of bilingualism that speakers of languages of wider communication like English typically have access to, where in the process of learning a second language, there's very, very little chance that your first language is threatened or undermined. And subtractive bilingualism, which is the kind of bilingualism that the children of immigrants typically undergo. They might speak an important language, a language of wider communication like Spanish, but that doesn't mean that when they immigrate to the States, Spanish has sufficient status or social support that they will maintain and continue to develop it. So that's a situation where learning English often comes at the expense of maintaining and continuing to develop Spanish. A lot of the evidence about the positive effects of bilingualism derive from situations in which bilinguals are what you might think of as active bilinguals. They actually switch back and forth in a given day from the first language to the second language. And that seems to be associated with a heightened level of executive function, of control over what might be automatic processes. So Ellen Bialystok and my colleague Gigi Luke, for example, have shown a greater executive function in active bilinguals. Those advantages are not so easy to detect in passive bilinguals, kids who study a foreign language, for example, in the classroom, but don't get confronted on a daily basis with actually having to use it. On the other hand, studying a language is also a tremendous resource for metalinguistic awareness, coming to understand how language works. And often it's easier to learn about grammar and etymology in a second language than in a first language, because the first language is so sort of automatic that you don't take the time to analyze it.
For a lot of children in Ireland, the second language that they learn first, if you like, or their first language is English, but then they learn Irish, mm-hmm. and the Irish language. Now, I don't expect you to know the nuances of that locally and how it's taught and so on, but One of the things that happens is that sometimes children who struggle with literacy or who have dyslexia or have other specific learning disabilities, they're given waivers that they don't have to study Irish. But other people have said to me, well, sometimes children who make progress in the second language, in Irish, it can actually enhance their first language. Would you have any views on that, the relative merits or demerits of, say, a language like Irish on a first language?
Yes, I don't know enough about Irish to be able to analyze the potential for insights about English. But certainly, I think there's a fairly robust body of literature suggesting that whereas dyslexics clearly have trouble learning second languages like they have trouble learning first languages, they don't have any more trouble because it's a second language. So the notion that there should be special treatment of dyslexics in second language acquisition is somewhat unfounded. In 40 years ago, in the studies that were done in Montreal in immersion French programs for English-speaking kids, there was an early effort to exclude kids with language learning disabilities from the French immersion programs. But subsequently, an analysis was done that suggested that they functioned no worse in French immersion than they would have been expected to function in English-only programs. So I think it is, in a sense, a form of discrimination to say, well, because you've got this reading problem, you should be excluded from an educational opportunity that all of your classmates have. On the other hand, I have to say, as an outsider with insufficient knowledge of the situation, that a lot of time is spent in Irish schools teaching Irish, and I think the question is whether that time is, in general, optimally invested given the level of proficiency that the average student achieves.
That's a very big question, Catherine. You have spent your whole career in the area of literacy and working on literacy. How do you define literacy?
I define literacy actually rather narrowly compared to many people who would use the term literacy for any cognitive accomplishment. I think of literacy as related to print or text and as the set of skills that's associated, in, at least initially for any learner, with the particular challenges of translating written language into oral language. But then, of course, it expands quite quickly because having mastered the basics of translating written language into oral language gives one access to forms of language that we actually don't have access to typically purely through speaking. So complex syntactic constructions, complex discourse structures are actually typically encountered primarily through reading and not primarily through talking. What that means is that oral language is then influenced by rich exposure to written language. So I certainly see literacy as an interwoven complex of oral and written language skills.
And so it's not just that oral language comes first and then written language comes after, or I mean, you're saying it's a complex relationship between listening, reading, writing, and speaking.
It's clear that that language development, oral language development, after age, say, 10 or 12, continues, that we learn a lot about language after that age, but that much of that learning is mediated by reading and by being asked to write. And by being asked to talk about written texts. So language continues to develop because the tasks that one encounters continue to become more complex and challenging. And that happens in a context that's very much text mediated.
Because one of the things that you advocated in your talk this morning is that debates can help children develop their reading comprehension. How does that happen?
One mechanism that by which debates support reading comprehension is the motivation to go back to text to find more information to improve one's oral performance. So debates, good debaters are not just good talkers. They're also people who have evidence with which to support their claims. And if a student is going to be an effective debater about, I don't know, let's take a topic from our curriculum, were the pharaohs in ancient Egypt evil oppressors, or were they a source of productive stability, and was the level of oppression sort of acceptable given the level of stability? Well, you can't argue that just from opinion, right? You actually have to go read the text. How oppressive were they? What were the forms of oppression? How much stability was there? Who benefited from the economic union and the storehouses of grain and the mechanisms for taming the floods on the Nile? And you have to go get that information out of text, but there's no reason to go get that information just because, I mean, most sixth graders are not that naturally curious, quite frankly, about ancient Egypt. They want the information if it's going to help them and their team win the debate. So it's highly motivated reading if you put it at the service of solving a problem or answering a question or performing well in an oral context.
And where can teachers get good topics for debates like that one?
Well, obviously one source would be the Word Generation curriculum, which we have developed. But I think actually skilled teachers do this all the time. They turn rather simple questions into debatable questions. So, I mean, you might think, well, in math, what could you possibly find as a source of discussion? But in fact, in China and in Japan, math teachers do a lot of classroom discussion, and they organize the discussion not around what's the right answer, but around how did you get to the right answer? How did you solve this problem? And it turns out that in a class of 25 students, there might be 15 different solutions to any modestly complex problem. Even a problem as simple as what's 4 times 4? Because some kids will add and some kids will do 4 plus 4 is 8 and 8 plus 8 is 16, and some kids will actually just know the multiplication algorithm, and some kids will do a visual display, like if you've got 4 here and then count the squares. That there are a lot of ways of solving a problem like that, and hearing each other's solutions can also often be very helpful to kids. So there's sources of the potential for discussion that often just gets ignored. In social studies classrooms, I think, is perhaps the most obvious place, because every event in history is debatable, not perhaps what happened, but why it happened, how it influenced people, what different participants' perspectives on that event were. And highly debatable is the presentation of those events in textbooks, because they're always oversimplified and often distorted.
A teacher who's conscientious and who's anxious that their class is learning may find that the progress development or the development of learning language is slow. Or they may be concerned that if the children are just discussing, the discussion is never going beyond a certain level. How do you prevent that from happening, that you actually are raising the children and not just kind of allowing them to talk within their comfort zone all the time?
That's a very important issue, how you keep pushing the standards higher or the expectations higher. I'll have to say it doesn't bother me a whole lot in contrast to what's going on when kids have worksheets, because that's not pushing them beyond what they already know very often either. If you give a math problem and then you give a worksheet with 47 minor variations of that problem, they're really not learning very much from spending half an hour filling out that worksheet. Not learning very much that's generalizable to new contexts, at least. So on the one hand, I would say a major goal is to make sure kids come to school kind of eager and happy to be there. And that's much more likely to happen if they know they're going to have a chance to express their own points of view about things. But the key driver, I think, of ever more sophisticated uses of time devoted to discussion is the question, why do you think that? How do you know that? Because If discussion is just an exchange of opinions, which it probably appropriately is in second grade, or of unfounded testimony, like, well, my mommy thinks, or my dad said, or my big sister, but in subsequent grades, it can really be, I read in this article that, or it says here in the textbook that, or on the radio, I heard that, and pushing constantly for the support of that sort, and then questioning the quality of the support, right? Well, who did you hear it from on the radio, and how do you know you should trust him? And let's go do some research and see whether other people think that same thing. That's the kind of procedure that takes classroom discussion from being kind of somewhat aimless and enjoyable chat to being rigorous examination of claims.
You're clearly not a fan of children filling out worksheets, but in an era of accountability, teachers might say, well, at least if they fill out the worksheets, I have evidence that they did some work and I have something tangible that I can show afterwards. Whereas if I spend my time talking, the children will go home and say, well, we spent the whole day talking, and their parents will say, well, what did you learn today? And they'll say, well, we were just talking.
Well, I would suggest that teachers send home information to the parents about the key questions that had been discussed. And if it was a good discussion, then the kids, rather than taking home a worksheet, which parents perhaps never look at or have to initial and send back, they could have an interesting conversation at the dinner table about oppression in ancient Egypt and the degree to which the political situation in Egypt has progressed from the pharaohs to the post-Morsi era.
Okay. One of the things you emphasized in your presentation to Irish teachers this morning was the importance of acquiring vocabulary. And I suppose I was a little bit surprised that you talked about vocabulary rather than, you know, expressions or idioms and so on. Why is the acquisition of individual words so important?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think in the American context, idioms would be strongly emphasized in classrooms for second language learners. But the assumption would be you learn the idioms you need as a native speaker from casual conversation, whereas academic vocabulary items like hypothesize or negotiate or relegate, which in American English is quite an uncommon word, unlike for soccer, for football players around here, those words don't get acquired automatically. They might, even if heard, not really be noticed or learned. So the need is much greater to focus on them. And of course, we talk about it as vocabulary because that's the way teachers talk about it. But learning a vocabulary item always involves learning a syntactic structure. It always involves learning the expressions in which you use that word. So that kind of comes along with the vocabulary item.
And how do you move then from, say, a child hearing the word and knowing what it means to getting them to produce it in either their spoken language or their written language?
We tried in our vocabulary curriculum to embed opportunities that, in a sense, required students to use the word in speaking. So whenever possible, we incorporated the word into the burning question of the week. So if the burning question of the week is, should a post-high school year of public service be mandatory, then kids will have to use the word mandatory in discussing that question. The additional words that get taught in any week, we use them a lot. We model their use, and we encourage their use in writing. And this actually turns out to be a somewhat double-edged sword, because many teachers seize upon this idea that in the essays the kids write, they have to use all five of the words. And you end up getting maybe four sentences of an integrated essay that defends a position, perhaps even quite cogently, and then three unrelated sentences that are just stuck in there in order to use the word. So it's really, we try to balance our message to the teachers that good writing doesn't necessarily use a prescribed list of words. And doing a good job of writing is actually more important than using the words. But there is, on the other hand, a lot of evidence that even just writing the word out five times helps students remember what it sounds like and how to spell it. So I'm kind of mixed mind about whether we want the kids to be using the words less sensibly and more frequently.
And on that slightly ambivalent note about moving from recognizing words to producing them, that's it for today's Inside Education. On the next programme, I'll bring you the second part of my interview with Professor Catherine Snow from Harvard University. You can listen to more podcasts of Inside Education by going to the website seandelaney.com and clicking on podcasts. Until the next time, thank you for listening.